I'm Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. I've been a cop for 27 years. I like to say I got a backstage pass to life. Well, guess what? I got some tickets for you. So come on in, pull up a chair, turn up that volume, and let's go. Chasing Justice is on.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome aboard. You know, have you ever wanted to understand how criminal investigations take place? Has it ever interested you? I know the world of law enforcement is something that has been an interest of many people that are civilians, that are not part of law enforcement. I know ever since we've had, you know, radio, commercial radio, and then television and movies, there are umpteen myriad law enforcement stories, right? Remember all the TV shows? Cops was a reality TV show. But you had the Untouchables back in the day. You had Adam 12, T.J. Hooker. It just goes on and on and on. The Wire, the Hill Street Blues. It's a never-ending thing. And then movies. There are tons of movies about law enforcement. And really, what is it about that people find so interesting? Is it about the stories of the individual cops? It's really not. The interest that people have in crime and punishment, law and stories, is because it is an essential part of human nature. It is really a chase of good and evil, isn't it? Right? You got the good guys and girls, and they chase the bad guys and girls, and we all see this as an interesting part of humanity. So one of the things that I've done is I do a lot of police training. I train police officers to be ethical, do the right thing, protect their communities, and be the best officers that they can possibly be. And one way of doing that is teaching, and the other way is to write, to write out some of these things. So my first book is called The Interview. And it is a soup-to-nuts guide on how to conduct an interview. What's the psychological ramifications of talking with someone? How do you overcome denials? How do you overcome lying? How do you recognize lying? What is body language all about? And that's an interesting book, and it's good for anyone who has to do any kind of an interview. I do focus on the criminal aspects of an interview because, that's what I was, a criminal investigator. And I would sit down with people who committed rapes, robberies, murders, and try and get them to confess. That was the idea, to build a relationship with that person so that they trusted you enough to tell you the truth, or to use skills to tell when they were lying, to tell when they were trying to evade the truth or play a story. And it's really a very dynamic get-together with another human being, because both sides have a lot to win or lose, don't they? Say you sit down with someone who is a accused killer or accused rapist, and they have a great stake in the game, don't they? They need to talk to you, the law enforcement officer. They need to answer questions. They need to provide information that's asked of them in such a way that they keep themselves from getting in trouble, right? They want to lie to you, obfuscate, and dance around while looking like they're telling the truth. So when we think about criminal investigations, there's a distinct side. There's one side trying to get to the truth and the other side trying to keep the truth away. And that is apparent in how many other instances do we find that in human endeavor? So in the book, The Interview, which is from the publisher, blue360media.com, you can go get a copy. It's also on Amazon. It's a great book for anyone who in law enforcement, whether you're a patrol officer, detective, supervisor, whatever, to understand the dynamics of how human beings talk to each other and how to uncover, how to use body language and all these techniques to get to the truth. That's really the idea. But it's also good for anyone who has to interview with anybody. In the book, one of the things I use as an example is I tell the story of purchasing a car, because when you think about it, the thing that I say in the book is that every interaction between people, every single time you talk with someone, it is an interview. Now, there's different levels of concern in each interview. Obviously, the highest concern being the criminal interview. When you, if you say the wrong thing or you tell the truth or the truth comes out, you may have a potential of going to prison forever or death penalty or whatever. So that's like the highest stake. But in the book, I use as an example to show how this can be used anywhere, the dynamics of dealing with another human being in a conversation to get to the truth. I use the example of a car dealer. Now, if anyone has ever purchased a car, you know that it's not considered the most fun. Now, it's exciting to get a new car, right? That's fun. Once you drive it off the lot, that's a really a good time. But the whole process of going through negotiating for the car, they're going to try and upsell you. The car salesman's job is to sell you the most expensive car with the most expensive warranty, with the most expensive upgrades that they can possibly get you to purchase. And they do that using a set of techniques, of interview techniques, and things that they learn about human beings. So one of the things I can tell you is this. Before I was in law enforcement, I did a couple of things. I took the sales route, right? I looked at sales because I could talk to people, and I understood the highest paid professionals always are commissioned salespeople. They make the most money in our country. And I thought, okay, maybe I can do some sales. Maybe that'll be a good thing. So one of the first things I sold, believe it or not, were Cutco knives. Now, Cutco knives have been around forever and ever. They are a very high-quality American product. The knives are actually great. I mean, they really are good knives. They basically sell themselves. I don't know how popular they are now. I know they're still around. But back in the day, in the 70s and the 80s, I mean, Cutco knives you bought from a salesman, they were awesome, amazing knives. And they come with lifetime guarantee. It's pretty funny. I sold them in, geez, like I said, it had to be like 1982 or 83, 84, sometime around them. I don't know how I got hooked up with it, but I got hooked up with a person who was selling them. And I looked at them and I bought a couple of knives. My mother had Cutco knives from the 1960s. And the salesman said, oh, they got a lifetime guarantee. So she had this little steak knife, one of the only three or four left from the set she had from when she got married in 1959. And it had a chip in the blade. And she goes, oh, the guy's salesman says, no problem. Send it in, get a new one. And she did. She sent it in. She got a new one after all them years. So I was impressed by that. I was impressed by the way the salesman showed me how sharp the knives were. It's kind of like that modern commercial, you know, the Ginsu knife. It can cut a can in half, and then it can cut a tomato. That's pretty impressive, right? You see things like, and you go, wow, I could use that. Well, I got into selling these knives, and one of the techniques, besides explaining to me why very sharp knives are important in food preparation and eating, and then the guarantee, you know, they lead you down this whole list of things that you end up saying, boy, that's great. That's great. That's awesome. That's awesome. I could see myself having them. Then he takes a big chunk of leather, a piece of leather like a belt, right? And he folds it in half so that it is really thick. And he takes this Cutco knife and he slices that leather like it wasn't even there. And I'm telling you, that was impressive. So then he made, you know, you buy the kit, right? That's one of the ways the company makes money. You buy, salesmen buy the kit. That's like Tupperware, right? You want to be a Tupperware salesman, you got to buy the kit. Just about any type of sales, you have to buy the initial set of things so you can show them. And that's legitimate, right? So I started selling Cutco knives. And then I found that while I thought they were impressive and other people thought they were impressive, then it came to the price. And they're not cheap. They're not like you go to, you know, the 5 and 10 at the time where you go to Kmart or Walmart or somewhere and you get a set of knives and they're very reasonable price. They were expensive. Now, the difference was is that they were quality, right? You're going to pay for quality. But when I was a young person, you know, I didn't have a lot of money. So the idea of paying, you know, $25 for a single steak knife, and I don't remember if that was the price, but that's what it seemed like at the time, to pay $25 for a steak knife was completely out of the question. But the salesman also told me, if I bought a kit, invested in a kit, went out and sold them, first of all, I'd make money. It would be like a job. I could name my own hours. I'd be selling people quality products. I would make money doing it, and I would get free pieces of equipment, right? So you put all that together, and the salesman convinced me that, hey, this is something I could do. It's worthwhile, and I believed in it. So I went out, and I started to try and sell Cutco knives. And what I found was you normally sell within your own circle of people. And I was selling to young people, young couples like myself and my wife who were just starting out, and they didn't have $1,000 for a set of knives, you know, and they just they would buy one steak knife, or they'd buy a paring knife to be nice to me and buy it. So I wasn't making the money I thought I was going to make. Then I went to my cousin Charlie's house. Now, Charlie was a law enforcement officer, and he was a guy that he understood quality. He had been on the job a while. He was making money. And he says, "Let me see them Cutco knives. I used to have them. Let me see a demonstration." And I went over, and I demonstrated cutting the leather, and I cut a can, and I cut a tomato, and I showed him the quality of workmanship. And I was enthusiastic about it. And I believed in all. And at the end, he told me, he goes, "Okay, I'll take a set." I said, "What do you mean a set?" He goes, "I'll take a set, the whole set." And I think at the time, even in like 1983, the whole set was $1,200 or $1,500. And he wrote me a check. And my commission on that was probably like $150. That was a lot of money going back to that time for a young person. $150 for one sale. Boy, was I enthused. If I sold this three times a week, I'd be rolling in the dough. The bottom line was, I had learned some basic techniques of dealing with someone to overcome their denial. Denial is no. They don't want to buy something. They don't want to hear it. We say it now. People call on the phone, right? What do you say? "No, thanks." And you hang up because you don't want to hear the pitch. Well, as I got older, I then sold waterbeds. I got into waterbed sales. Why? Because they were very popular in the 1980s. They were easy to sell. Everybody wanted one. And all I had to do was basically be enthusiastic about it. To this day, Miss Kathy and I still sleep on a waterbed, right? How many, 50 years later, because they're the most comfortable things. They're nice and warm in the winter. I love them. I'm a big proponent of waterbeds, although they've fallen out of style in recent years. They're still out there. My kids had waterbeds until like 2 years ago when they moved out to go to college and stuff. But the bottom line was, I sold waterbeds, and a lot of the same techniques were taught in selling waterbeds. And one of the things, we had a training program where I think there were 10 stores in the chain of this waterbed chain. And what you had to do once a week, you as a salesperson, you had to go to one of the 10 stores, and there was a guy there that taught sales techniques. And you would go there, and you had to know all your products. You had to know the cabinets that went with the waterbed, the kind of mattresses, the heaters, all these kind of things that the accoutrements that go with waterbeds, the sheets, silk sheets or leather sheets or this kind of sheets, and all these different things that you can buy extra, upsell the customer, and you made a spiff, they called it, a commission on each little piece. So I tried it, and it was local. The store was local. I got there at 10 in the morning. We worked until 9 o'clock at night, and I was selling waterbeds, making a lot of money. I was making a big commission check, more money than just about anything else I had ever done. And I was in a suit and tie. I was inside a building in the wintertime. I was inside a warmed up building in the summertime, an air conditioned building. And I really did enjoy the sales thing. So as time went by, though, you started to see the techniques that we were taught by this sales guy. And he was really very, very good. He was a nice guy. He was slick. He was a slick salesman, but he was personable. And that was one of the things. And what he taught me was this, was that, and it goes for car salesmen too, because I left the waterbeds. Actually, I went to a car place first, and I left the cars, and I went to waterbeds. And I'll tell you that part of the story first. I went to a very popular car dealer around here that sold tons and tons of cars, because I said, if I could sell knives, I could sell cars. There's big commissions. And I went in, and they hired me, and they said, this is how much commission you make, and if you upsell and you get them to buy fancy wheels and you get them to buy a bigger transmission or whatever, you get all this commission check off the car. And they taught me techniques on how to do this. And this is what soured me on cars, because we all think that car salesmen are out there to cheat you and get money out of it. And they are. They're there to make money. Their job is to upsell you and to convince you to buy something you can't afford and this and that. So there was an example, and this was the example that got me at it. I was there for about 3 weeks. I think I sold three or four cars because I liked the model of the car and I could talk about it convincingly, and people needed a car, so they bought the car. But I'd only sold three or four of them. And then we had a training session, and the trainer says to me, "Okay, here's the example. Do you want to make money?" "Yes, I do." He goes, "All right, so there is a chartreuse blue car that we make, right? This fancy car. There's only one made in chartreuse blue. And it's sitting on the lot. And Mrs. Jones comes in, an elderly woman, and she really wants that car. You sell it to her and she pays cash. And she says, I'll be back in 3 hours to pick up my new car. And you're very excited because you sold this car. It's a unique color and you're glad that, you know, you sold it and she paid cash. It's all good. And she'll be back in 3 hours. Now, she leaves the dealership and 15 minutes later, a guy walks in and goes, I love that chartreuse car over there. I want to buy that. And the sales director says to me, okay, what are you going to do? And I thought about it. And I thought it was a trick question because, you know, I told you, the woman came in, she loved it, she bought it, she paid cash for it. She signed the sales receipt and she left and she was going to come back and pick it up. So I said, well, I would try and convince him to take another car, same model in a different color, trying to find a car he really liked. They go, no, he wants that car and he wants to buy it right now. What do you do? And then it started to dawn on me that no matter how much I was going to give an answer like, just do the right thing and, you know, buy the car, you know, sell him a different kind. The answer was not that. And the guy says to me, no, what you do is you sell him that chartreuse car sitting on the lot. And if he's willing to drive away with it before Mrs. Jones shows back up to pick it up, you let him drive away with it. And when she gets there, you sell her a different car. And I said, how is that proper? Didn't she buy the car? He goes, well, she didn't take delivery yet. And you could sell that car. You know she wants it. So when she comes back, she will buy another one. We'll tell her it got a damage or it had something else. And then you have sold two cars. And I said, wow, that didn't feel comfortable. That really did not feel comfortable. It kind of revealed to me, and I'm not saying every car dealer's like that. I'm not saying they're not. But I've dealt with enough of them over the course of my life. I've known people that sell cars, and I was there. This is what they were teaching me to do these things that were like, hey, just sell. Your job is to sell. You make money when you sell. So just sell and you figure it out later. So I left the cars and I went to waterbeds because I figured how bad could you screw people over with a waterbed? You know, they got a waterbed. And when I got there, like I said, we had to go on this training and the guy would walk you around the building and he'd say, okay, here's the truth about people. And this is important. This is why it's in my book about interviewing, because it was an insight into humanity that this guy had as a good salesman. He says, okay, you walk around with your clipboard, and on your clipboard, it has the make and model, the size of the bed, king size, queen size, whatever. It has the kind of wood, oak, birch, pine, whatever it is that you want, the colors, light color, dark color. Do you want the heater? You know, the heaters are on there. Are they the specialty heater or are they one that comes with the bed? Do you want regular sheets or silk sheet? All these things are on this clipboard. And he says, you walk around with this clipboard and you see people looking at a bed and you watch them to see if they have some interest. Then you go over, introduce yourself. Hi, I'm Joe. I see you have some interest in this black lacquer king size waterbed. Are you interested in the entire collection, which would be dressers, night tables, mirrors, and the bed and the frame and the mattress and all that? The reason you start with that is you want to gauge these people out. You want to set a baseline. What are they looking for? Right? Because if they wanted the whole collection and all you talked about was the bed, you lost out. So you start with the big picture and you try and move them to the whole collection. And then break it down. Okay, maybe they don't take the collection with the two dressers and the two night tables and the bed. Maybe they take two night tables and the bed, or maybe they take one night table and a dresser. So you increase your sales, right? That's the idea. So that was the whole psychology. As you ask people questions, like, are you looking at king size or queen size? And if they say, well, we think we're looking at the queen size, you mark that down on the paper. And a lot of times what he told us is he goes, you will see people say, listen, I didn't say I'm buying anything. You don't have to write anything down. No, I'm not writing it down to sell it to you. I'm writing it down so that I can keep track of what you like. I'm your salesman. I'm here to try and help you. Oh, okay. So what you're doing there is a technique. What he told me, and I found it to be absolutely true, is that 8 out of 10 people that walk onto a car lot, go into a furniture store, go to a rug place, go any place that they sell thing based on commission, anytime that you go in there, if they can get you to say yes, say 8 out of 10 times, or get you to pick something 8 out of 10 times, when it comes time to say, do you want to buy it now? 8 out of 10 people cannot say no. Not that they're stupid, not that they're whatever, but a lot of people, and you may have felt this at one time, you spend a lot of time with a car salesman, and then you get down to the end, and you really want the car, but it's more money than you thought, and you want to leave. You want to leave the car dealership and walk away, but you don't. How come? Because you feel bad that you spent all that time with the salesman. He spent all that time with you, or she spent all that time with you, and now you're going to leave. So you feel guilty. You feel bad. So that's why if they can get you to say yes or agree or give your ideas, 8 out of 10 times, 8 out of 10 people can't say no. So when it came to the cars, and I use that in the book because we all fall prey to that. You pull on the car lot, right? And the salesman comes running out to you. Hey, how you doing? What are you looking at? Is you going to trade that in? Or you going to? They start overwhelming you with questions, right? And puts us at a disadvantage. So in the book, the interview, what I talk about is the salesman will say to you, so you like that Camaro, right? Are you looking for the 8-cylinder or the 6-cylinder? And you say, listen, I don't know if I'm buying. I'm just here to look. Well, first of all, if you're on a car lot and you're actually looking at cars, maybe you're a looky-loo. Maybe you're somebody that just wanted to take a look because you like Camaros. But most of us, we go on a car lot because we've decided we need a car or we want a car. We've got to upgrade a car. Our car is old. Whatever it is, we are there because we're there to buy. The salesman knows that. The salesman just has to overcome our concerns about buying a car. It's too expensive. It's too much of a payment. But they know that you're there to buy a car. So I saw over the course of my life when I bought these cars, if there was a salesman who introduced himself and said, hey, no problem, you take a look, I'll be inside. The reality is, when people show up to buy something from a commissioned place, you are called an up, a UP. That's my up. Now they use different names in places, but the salesmen all know they're in order. You know, starting the day, Bill gets the first customer on the lot. Frank gets the next customer. Tina gets the third customer. So it's not like it's random what salesman came out to you. It's that who happens to be up, right? So you're an up. So now you come on the lot and a smart salesman would say to you, you know, I'll be inside if you have any questions, because there's no chance another salesman's going to take you away. But I have now just cut the pressure off of you that you expect a salesman to do, and I'm inside. So what happens? I start looking around at the cars, and I finally settle on the Charger. I really wanted a Charger. I looked at some other ones, and boy, I really want a Charger. Now, if I need to go the next step, other than just looking, I'm there to buy, I got to go in and find the salesman. Hey, Harry, I got a couple questions for you. Oh, you do? Let me help you, Joe. Right? So right off the bat, Harry is in the driver's seat, so to speak. And then he comes out, he might say to me, are you looking about the 6-cylinder or the 8-cylinder, Joe? I said, if I'm going to buy something, I want an 8-cylinder. Oh, and he marks it down, an 8-cylinder. Okay. And I say, hey, listen, I'm just looking. Yeah, no problem, but I'm just trying to keep track of what you like. Isn't that nice when salesmen keep track of you? Joe, did you like it? It's in gray here. Did you like it in gray? Or see, there's a red one over there with an 8-cylinder. Did you like the red or the gray better? I don't know. You know, I think I like the red. How much difference is in cost? They're actually the same price, but the red is a little peppier. It's a little sharper looking. Some people like gray, but red is really sharp. Oh, okay. But I don't know. I don't know if I can afford it. So you go round and round with the salesman, and they keep asking you questions. Do you want leather interior? Well, this one has cloth. Well, you save a lot of money with the cloth. They say the things I need to hear. You're going to save a lot of money. Even if I really wanted the leather interior, now he just told me leather's more expensive. Here's the car with an 8-cylinder engine. It's in red. It looks sharp. It's the kind you like. And you're going to save money if you get the cloth interior instead of the leather. So if I say, well, you know, that's really good, but I really did want the leather. Is there anything in the same price with leather? And he might say, well, not in red, but I have it in blue over here. It's a little bit more, but it also has some more features. Now, depending on me personally, am I now getting hooked into the idea of having this really cool Charger with a V8 engine in a really cool color blue with leather interior? I start to envision myself in that car, and I'm buying into it. I'm doing the salesman's work for him or her. Right. So then we go over and we start looking. I say, OK, Joe, if you had to pick one today. Right. I'm not saying you're going to buy today, but if you had to buy one today, do you think you'd get the red one or do you think you'd get the blue one? And I don't know. I think I take the blue one. I just don't know if I have the money for it. Well, Joe, let me tell you, how much do you think you could put down? Now, I could put down $2,500, but I don't want to say that. I don't want to give in to the salesman. I want the lowest price, right, for the lowest amount down. So, well, you know, I could probably put down $2,000, you know, if I was going to buy. I don't know if I'm going to buy, but if I was going to buy, I could put down $2,000, you know, as long as the price was right. Now, experts in car sales will tell you, you never say a couple things to the dealer. This is how much I want to pay per month, because then they got you. They can make the deal work out for the amount you want to pay, and they make the most. Stick to what you're willing to pay for the total price of the car, and then you work it out. But anyway, the salesman knows these things about me. They start to see that I'm getting hooked into buying this car, and they continue to ask me these questions. So, Joe, let me ask you something. You said you really like the blue, right? That's correct. Yes, I like the blue. You like the V8 engine, right? It's powerful. It's what you're looking for. Yeah, that is what I'm looking for. You like those specialty wheels. They look sharp, right? I could see you driving that in the summertime and with the glints on the wheel. That looks cool, right? You like that? Yeah. It's automatic, right? Is that what you wanted? Yes, that's really good. Joe, if I could get you that car right there that you love, if I could get it for you for the price that you want to pay, would you buy it today? This is the point where the salesman has you over the barrel. I have just said, I like everything about that car. I like everything about it. My only concern was, could I afford it? And I, you know, what am I supposed to say? 8 out of 10 people at that point are going to either go, yeah, I'll buy it. Or they're going to go, well, I just don't know, what's it going to cost? And that's when they say, let's go in the office and I'll talk to my manager. Now, that's another scam. They go back and forth with the manager. And then, you know, it's $58 a month more than you wanted to pay, but it's all those things. And you've been there all day and you're tired and you spent all this time with the salesman. You're not going to, okay, all right, I'll take it. $58 more a month, I'll take it. And then they go through all the paperwork and then you buy the car and out the door you go. So the whole idea is that that's an interview. That salesman had a goal in mind to get you to buy the car. He had techniques to get you to say yes all those times, because he knew psychologically that if you said yes all them times, when it came down to you, are you ready to buy? 8 out of 10 people will say yes. And that's the same thing with any kind of an interview. There's a way to get you to the point you need to be at for that person to confess, for them to break down and trust you and say things. So I put that example in the book as a way for people to understand that interview techniques are not just about confessing to murder or buying a car, but anytime two people talk and have to negotiate anything, the person with the knowledge of how human nature works and the techniques and the practice can overcome the other person. All right, so this is interesting for the beginning here in this law enforcement. When we come back, we're going to talk about my other book and criminal investigation and how we do that.
Don't accept joint aches and stiffness as part of aging. Doctors at Advanced Nutrition Company, Healthy Cell, created Joint Health and Mobility to support connective tissue, joint lubrication, and reduce joint irritation with curcumin, omega-3, chondroitin, glucosamine, and hyaluronic acid for joint comfort and flexibility. And Healthy Cell's not a pill, it's a gel you swallow. Get 100% drug-free joint support. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. That's HealthyCell.com. Code out loud.
Who's got time for a nasal invasion messing up your lifestyle? Crush those nasties before they become a problem. For a limited time, when you add the new Cofix RX throat spray to your order with the coupon code OUTLOUD, you'll receive 20% off the entire purchase. Go to AmericaOutLoud.shop. That's AmericaOutLoud.shop and use coupon code OUTLOUD.
Use Cofix RX because it works.
Cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, inflammation, and weight. These are all real-world problems that 87% of Americans are struggling with. Often, there are no symptoms, but left unattended, we become inundated with one health problem after another. It's time to fight back with HealRight. HealRight is a bar that you eat, but it's food as medicine that addresses the nutritional root cause of health issues in just 8 weeks. Developed by world-renowned scientists and backed by 15 years of research, HealRight is effective, but it's also delicious and works without additional diet or lifestyle changes. Step out of the statistics and use food as medicine. Visit HealRight.com/OutLoud or AmericaOutLoud.shop and use the code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
A when God, through his grace and mercy, gave us free will, the will of the people was to live freely. To that end, we fight for the liberty of all at a time when global tyranny threatens us as never before in mankind's history. This vision is manifest at AmericaOutloud.news, a site for all who cherish free will and freedom. Now is our time, my fellow Americans. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
All right, everybody, welcome back. See, I think, you know, we can talk about politics all day. We can talk about all these other things. This whole thing of law enforcement, the reason I was talking about it, and I want to talk about my books a little bit, is because there is such a market for law enforcement things, because law enforcement is interesting stuff. Understanding how to have an interview and how the dynamics of an interview work can help you when you're going for a job. When you're going for that job interview, these techniques help people to control the job interview, to get the job. It can help you when you're negotiating anything, if you know how it works and who has something to gain. Understanding the psychological techniques that are used in professional interviews can help you in many, many ways. So that's why we're talking about in the world of law enforcement, when we use these techniques, understanding human nature, it helps us when we're talking to someone, because say you committed a really bad crime, a devastating crime, you murdered somebody. There's motive, there's reason. Was it a spur of the moment murder? Was it, were you murdering somebody because you were being paid to wipe them out so somebody else could get insurance money? Did you murder them because you hate them and you were jealous of them? Did you murder them for other kind of financial gain? Were you robbing them and they fought back and you killed them? Those kind of things. Now you have to sit in with a law enforcement officer, and the answers you give will determine whether or not you go to prison or maybe get the death penalty or you get to walk out of the building. So police work has always been that good against evil. And that is where, once you get into the business, you understand how that works and you understand human nature. It helps you in all of your investigations, right? So I was a patrol officer, and I had to deal with people as the first officer, usually on scene. And then if it was a more advanced crime, you'd bring detectives in and people had to be interviewed. They'd go back to headquarters or they'd be interviewed on the scene or whatever. So the understanding how to do an interview is extremely important. So that's why I wrote that book. And I've had hundreds of cops who have read the book say to me, "Oh my gosh, the techniques in there really work." And there's an interesting technique I'll tell you about. And this is really, it's kind of a law enforcement story, but you see why people get hooked in. It's why true crime podcasts and true crime movies and books have always been big sellers, because it is an amazing thing to be on the inside of a law enforcement investigation. When I signed up, I signed up to be a patrolman, to ride around in a police car in uniform and protect and serve my community. You know, I didn't know much about it. I didn't understand the intricacies of investigations. I had been around investigations a couple of times in my life. People around me were involved with things, and I saw how they kind of went, and I had an idea, but I had no idea once I got into it how awesome it was, how great. You know, the first time I got somebody to admit to me that they did something really bad was one of the most amazing moments of my life. I was totally hooked on the job at that point. I couldn't believe that they paid me to do this kind of work. And then I started to develop over time into a better and better investigator, a better and better interviewer. It got to the point that I had a better than probably 80% chance, if I sat down with someone accused of a crime, that I would get them to confess. Not all the time. Some people are professionals and they don't admit nothing. They ask for an attorney, whatever. But the average crime, whether it be a murder, rape, drug dealer, whatever, if I sat down with them, I got good to the point that I could probably elicit some information from them, which leads to more investigation, then figure out how to break them down. No, not with violence, with psychological techniques. And here's what it all comes down to. Here's what it all comes down to. When you're sitting there with that person, that criminal, no matter what horrible thing they've done, you have to suspend your feelings about that person. All right. So no matter if this person did multiple rapes or this person beat someone to death during a robbery and you find that they are a disgusting human being, how could they do such a thing? If you have that attitude in the interview, that person will feel that and they will see it and they will shut up. They will not talk to you. What you have to do in a criminal interview is you have to develop a rapport with that person. You have to find a connection with that person. Now, how do you find a connection with somebody who's committed a sexual assault? You can't, because you're not a sexual assaulter. But you have to find some way to connect to them, their feelings and whatever, and make a little bit of a bond between you and that person where they feel comfortable enough to talk to you, maybe not confess, but at least to talk to you. And then you don't just go right after. So did you commit the crime? You start talking about other things. There's all kinds of techniques involved to get someone to slowly but surely break down. You catch them in lies. And you don't go, see, you lied about that. I caught you. What you do is, you know, I'm confused. You know, remember Columbo? You know, I got one more question. You say things like, well, listen, Frank, you just told me you weren't there at all. And that was 20 minutes ago. And now you just kind of said to me you went in there for a cup of coffee. So how could you not be there and went for a cup of coffee? Well, once they felt comfortable with you, and their guard comes down a little, they say things they don't expect to say, right? So one of the techniques for an interviewer, a criminal interviewer, is to pose a question to the person, an innocuous enough question, and then let them talk. What I see lots of new investigators do is that they talk on top of, they ask a question, the person starts to answer, then they jump on top of them and they ask another question, and they jump on top of them and ask, they never let the person talk. See, so as you become seasoned at it, you'll ask a question. And then you'll let the person talk. Sometimes you don't do a follow-up. You just sit there in silence. And people feel a need to fill the gap. And so they'll say more things and they'll start saying something else. Maybe they say something that they didn't expect to say. And the more comfortable they are, the more their guard comes down, the more the truth may slip out and you're paying attention, right? So in most criminal interviews, not only do you have two detectives talking to the person, you also have other detectives watching on another camera. And there's reasons for this. So the reason you have two detectives in a room, not as a witness to prove that somebody said something, you have two detectives in there because the first detective asks the questions, right? So the lead detective, say it's my case, the lead detective asks the questions, tries to build up the information and elicit answers. The second detective in the room is watching for the body communication of the person and see how they respond to questions. What is their body language telling, right? So here I am asking all these questions and the other detective is watching for the reactions, physical reactions, like somebody's vein starts to beat in their neck real big because they're nervous or their heart rate goes up, or they start to sweat, or they start to twitch, or their feet start to tap under the table because they're nervous. And that person, that second detective, will pay attention to those kind of things while I'm trying to run a set of questions. I have a place I want to go from point A to point B I'm going to ask about. And then you see the detectives take a break. Hey, listen, Harry, you want a cup of coffee? Me and my partner are going to step out and get a cup of coffee. You want a cup of coffee? Right, because you're trying to build a rapport with the person. You want them to think you don't think they're so horrible. You know, you're just a guy. I'm getting a cup of coffee. You want one? Sure. You go and get a cup of coffee. When you're out there, your partner says, hey, listen, this is what I saw. That's what I saw. This really bothered him or this affected him. Go back and ask more about that, right? So that's how that works. So as an example, my partner Chuck and I worked together as patrol officers. Chuck went in the detective bureau about 8 months before I did. He was very talented, natural guy, unassuming kind of person, very, very smart. So he went in ahead of me, and about 8 months later, I got promoted and transferred into the detective bureau, and we worked together on a lot of things. And because we were close personally as friends, our families were close, everybody was close, we knew each other really very well. We had worked on so many different cases that we kind of knew When Chuck was the lead, I knew his style. I knew how he asked questions. I knew how his mind worked. So when I heard him start off on a series of questions, I knew where he was going and that I was watching for body language and reactions. Same thing the other way. If I was the lead, Chuck knew me. He knew how I asked questions. He knew how I tried to get the person to make an admission or to say something. And we balanced off of each other. So we had this case, and it was a rarely innocuous kind of a case. We had a multi-million-dollar home burn to the ground, right? It burned to the ground. And as cops, one of the first things we all say is that we are suspicious of everybody until we can prove they don't deserve to have you be suspicious of them. Because if you start out naive, sometimes people can get over on you. So we always thought that we're talking to this person, they did it. We just got to find the proof, right? And if our case realizes, teaches us there is no proof, then we say, well, okay, we can clear this person and walk away. And that's really the idea. You want to clear somebody out, or you want to make sure that you can see that they're in it, and then you pursue them appropriately. So this guy, he burned his house down. And at least that's what we thought, because it was a multi-million dollar house that burned down. Nobody was home when it burned down. Him, his wife, and his two kids were all down in Florida in Disneyland for vacation, and the house burned down. Now, do houses burn down all the time? They do. Does electrical wiring go bad? It does. Do appliances go bad? They do. The lightning strikes? Yes. All of those things happen legitimately. You'll find that out. You can tell. That's why the fire marshal comes and examines the electrical and can say, oh, this box overheated and burned, right? That it happens, legitimate. But we didn't like the fact that we started to find out that this circumstances were a little weird. First of all, the wife and the two children flew down to Disneyland on a Wednesday. And our guy, Frank, the homeowner guy, he didn't go down until Thursday night. And Thursday night, the house burned down. So we're immediately suspicious because that's weird. Do you and your family go to fly to another state for vacation in different airplanes? Two sets of plane tickets, two sets. Do you do that? Most of us do not do that. And one of the things a good investigator learns is that you can't take all of your life experience and think everything around you has to be based on your life experience. You got to be open. You got to be wide open to other experiences. Things go in different ways. So you learn. You learn over time. But we immediately found that suspicious because, you know, who does that? I don't do that. We go to Florida. We all go on the same plane. We come home the same day. My kids don't go early. So we were suspicious. So we asked this man. We call him up, tell him his house burned down. You know, he was very upset. And he says, okay, we'll all be home tomorrow. Said, okay, could you come in? We need to talk to you. Okay, we're going to come in. He's going to talk to us. So Chuck was the lead on this particular case. The fire marshal was out there poking around at the house and trying to figure out the cause. And we said, we're going to interview him. And you let us know if you find, you know, what caused the fire and this and that. And sometimes it's just a cursory interview. The electrical box burned. Sorry, your house burned down. We interviewed him and we cleared him out. And we move on. So we get this guy and he comes into headquarters and he's a nice enough guy. He's a high-end businessman making lots and lots of money, gives his family a wonderful lifestyle, really interesting stuff. So one of the first things we found out is that it was not unusual for this man's family to go on vacation like this because this man had business obligations that he couldn't just drop of a hat and go off. So we'd send his wife and his kids a day, 2 days ahead, whatever their timing was, because that's how much time, that's when they could get off from school. So he sent them ahead and I'll be there in a day or 2 days and I'll join up and we'll have a nice vacation. That was not unusual for him. So while Chuck and I thought that was unusual because it wasn't our lifestyle, when we looked into it, we found out this man has done this many times. This family has done this repeatedly. When he had to stay for business, he sent the wife and kids ahead. You know, they had Easter week off or whatever. So he would send them and he would come down when he could. So that really was an eye-opening thing. There's some facts here that I'll tell you at the end that continued to make us suspicious. But the interview, how it worked out, is that the man came in and obviously he was nervous. People are nervous when they come in a police station. And he sits down and we start talking to him. Hey, listen, sorry that your house burned down. That must be really shocking. And he says, oh, it's terrible. I can't believe it. We love that house. My kid's growing up there. You know, all the things that you would expect somebody to say. And with that, you know, we said, hey, you want a cup of coffee? So sure. So we get cups of coffee. And there's a reason we do that. First of all, everything's being recorded on video and audio. And we're recording that because we're trying to show people who watch the video that we're not like the cops they see on TV. Nobody's threatening this guy. Nobody's hitting him with a phone book or making accusations. We're just three men in a room talking about the house that burned down. Do you want a cup of coffee? Sure, let me get you a cup of coffee. It helps put the person at ease as well. Because what do people do? You break bread, you talk, you relax. I've been on investigations and interviews with people who committed murder. I spent days with them and I ate meals with them. I brought in breakfast. We ate breakfast. We watched TV. We did lots of things to build up the bond, right? It's what you have to do. So this guy is comfortable. Now he's having his cup of coffee. And Chuck asks him some innocuous questions, what we call setting the baseline, right? So when people are under stress, especially the stress of lying, it creates different body language. It creates the use of different words. It changes the pattern of how they say things. It changes the pattern of how they look at you in the face, how their eyes move. All these things change when you're under jeopardy. And that's what we call it, being under jeopardy. When you have jeopardy, you react and behave differently than when you don't have jeopardy. So we want to set a baseline first to understand, how do you answer questions? How do you physically move and behave when you're not under jeopardy? So how do you do that? You start the interview with a cup of coffee. You talk about anything but the crime questions. You talk about anything else. So if somebody came in and they were wearing a Mets t-shirt or something, I might say, hey, you're a fan of the Mets? And talk about the Mets for 10 minutes, right? That's not criminal related. There's no jeopardy in that person talking about the Mets. And you would see, do they look you in the eyes when they answer? Do they answer quickly? Do they have recall of information? Goes back a couple years talking about the Mets statistics and the players and all that. They answer in relatively good speed. They laugh. They're relaxing. They're breathing normal. Their body language is open and relaxed. And you look at all of that and you set that baseline. It could be 5 minutes, could be 20 minutes, depending on the crime. You know, you want to get a good baseline of how the person responds. So then Chuck says to him, hey, listen, so, where do you stay? You know, down in Disneyland. And the guy said, oh, well, we stay at the Grand Floridian. It's really beautiful there. You know, it's a wonderful place. And so we start talking about the Grand Floridian. I said, oh my gosh, I've seen that place. It's gorgeous. I'd love to stay there, but man, isn't it expensive? And the guy says, oh yeah, yeah. It's like $600 or $700 a night, but it's well worth it. You know, they have all these amenities and it's, oh, that's really great. And he's looking us in the eyes. He's recalling, they have musicians in the rooms. It's wonderful. And everybody's laughing. And we're having a nice time talking about Disneyland. We had a pretty good baseline of how he answered when he had no jeopardy. And then Chuck says, well, you know, that's really awesome. I think maybe, you know, we usually stay at the Caribbean Beach, but I might try this Grand Floridian. It sounds really good. I think you'd really love it. It's expensive, but I think you'd love it. Chuck says, okay, let's talk about the house for a minute. Well, when Chuck said that, that was the introduction of jeopardy. Right, because now we're going to talk about the house, and so it's not talking about fun, easygoing stuff. And we immediately see a reaction, right? So what he should have said, if he had nothing to do with burning down his house, he might have said, "Oh man, that is terrible. Can you believe that? My house burns down. What's the chances? What? They find out with the electrical box? I mean, geez, you know." And he'd be upset, but he'd still be making eye contact. He'd still be talking to us like three guys in a room talking over a cup of coffee. But instead, he didn't. We noticed that he physically sat up taller in the chair. He took a deep breath. His breathing pattern clearly changed. His eyes focused on us. And every time he looked at me or Chuck and we sat there in silence for a second, he would look down and he'd look away. Now, why is that important? Because it was a stark difference in how he was when he had no jeopardy. Now he's got jeopardy. We're going to talk about the house. And Chuck was the lead investigator, so he's asking the questions. And he says, when's the last time you had the house inspected? Have you had any electrical problems? And no electrical problems. I mean, we had a lamp that didn't work so good. But other than that, there was no electric. Oh, and he's answering questions. And Chuck's saying, have you smelled smoke or anything electric, anything you think would have happened to start a fire? And the guy starts thinking, and I notice that I'm watching him, and he's now much more tense. He's only answering the questions Chuck's asking. He's no longer lighthearted. I can see he's breathing different, and the vein in his neck is pumping away a mile a minute. The fact that I can see the vein in his neck is sticking out, popping out every time his heart beats. Now, I notice that, and I say, okay, that is an indicator of deception, right? So that's what we look for. In an investigation, in an interview, we look for two things. We look for truth and we look for deception. And the reality is, if somebody is being deceptive, that does not mean that they are guilty. It can mean they're guilty, but it means they're trying to keep something away from us for some reason. And that reason could be many, many things other than guilt. But guilt is certainly one of them. So I see that, and underneath the table, I tap Chuck on the foot. Now, Chuck doesn't know what I saw, but he knows I saw something. And that tap under the table is where our years of experience together tells him that I want him to stop the crime questions and go back to nonsensical conversation, because I want to see how the body language changes when the stress comes off. So Chuck says something along the lines of, well, yeah, you know, that's really strange. You know, electrical things happen in houses all the time, and you never know. I mean, I don't think there was a storm, but there could have been a lightning strike. But, you know, the fire inspector will tell us what he found. The guy's like, yeah, I guess it could be anything. And then Chuck pivots back to Florida. He goes, so now when you go down there, do you get a discount on tickets or anything if you stay at the Grand Floridian? Do you get meal specials? And now the guy is a little confused because he was all set up to be defensive, but now we're talking about Disneyland again. So in his mind, the impression we have given him is that we are not really suspicious of him. We are simply having a conversation. So his guard starts to come down, right? And he's talking to us, and I notice after a minute, His hands now have separated. He's in an open posture. He's smiling again. His breathing has changed. He sat back in his chair. He crossed his leg. He seemed calm, and the vein in his neck stopped pumping out. So we went on and on with this for, I don't know, 2 or 3 minutes till I noticed a complete change physically and psychologically with the questions he was asking. So at that point, I tapped Chuck under the table again with my foot, which indicated to him that, I mean, go back to the crime questions, that I was viewing something. I saw enough of what I saw. Go back to the crime question. And he does. He goes, yeah, so that's really something. The more I think about this Grand Floridian, I think I'm going to book a trip there for next year with my family. But you know what? We really got to finish up our conversation about the house here and what happened and you know, that kind of. Do you have insurance on the house? How much insurance do you have on the house? You know, what's insured? Well, with that, just like clockwork, when Jeopardy was restored to the conversation, this guy sat differently. He put his hands together. He crossed his legs. He started looking up and down. He was breathing. And there goes his vein in his neck again. And with that, Chuck asked a few more questions, and I said, okay, I'm going to interject here now and see if I can take us now to the next level of this conversation. I said, Chuck, can I ask a question? Can I jump in here? And he said, yeah, sure. What do you got? I said, you know, hey, Frank, you know, I'm just trying to figure out this whole thing. I mean, it's pretty strange, you know, that you leave and then suddenly the house burns down. How unfortunate. I mean, good thing your family wasn't home. Yeah, and he goes, I know. Can you imagine if they were all there and the house burned? I said, I know. I said, can you tell me everything you did? What time did you get home from work that night? He goes, oh, I get home around 5 o'clock. And your wife and kids, they're all down in Florida and you're there by yourself. You're going that night, correct? Yes. Could you tell me everything you did from the time you got home from work to the time you headed for the airport? And how'd you head to the airport? Oh, I had a car service picking me up. Okay. So from the time you got home at 5 till 7:30 when you left in the car service, what did you do? What did you do when you were in the house? And I could see he takes a deep breath. And there's two kinds of breaths. There's the reinforcing breath, which people do before they lie. And then there's the defeat breath when they're about to tell the truth and they let it. We've all seen this in arguments with our spouses and friends and everybody when they finally tell the truth or they lie to us. They take a deep breath when they lie and then they let it out when they're about to tell the truth. So he takes a deep breath and he says, well, I got home. I parked my car in the garage. My wife made food, left it on a plate, so I ate some dinner. I told the neighbors we were going to be away for a couple of days to, you know, watch the mail. Then I went around and I checked the lights to make sure the lights were on timers. I turned off everything we didn't need on. I made sure the air conditioning was set the right way. I set up the house. I made sure that that there was a note out for the mailman, and you know, and then the car service showed up and I left. And I said, oh, okay. So in his conversation and the things that he said, you just heard me repeat them to you. The things that, is there anything that he said in there that sounded strange, that sounded weird? Like you might want to ask another question of him. Some people get it and some people don't. The reality is that's where I said you let people talk, right? You don't jump in and jump on top of them. The purpose of my questioning was to now focus him on a specific time, right? He left at 7:30 and the house burned down at 10 o'clock at night. And then, you know, he got the call at 11, whatever it was. So there's a time frame. I'm trying to focus him in and really poke his jeopardy, as we call it. So when he said to me, he says, well, I checked the timers on the lights. That's a normal thing to do, isn't it? If you have your house on timer, so the lights come and go, look like there's people home, you tell your neighbors, hey, neighbors, we're going to be away for 5 days. Can you check the mail for us? That's perfectly normal. He checked the temperature, right, to make sure that the house, you know, the pipes didn't freeze or the air conditioning stayed on, so the house stayed good while they were gone. And then he said something interesting. He said, I set up the house. Now, that's a strange thing to say, especially when you've just told me you check the heat, you check the air, you check the lights, you check the neighbors. What does set up the house mean? So the reality is when we let people talk in an interview, they will often say things unexpected. And here's why. If you were to lie, say you were to lie to your best friend, your boss, or your spouse, if you were to tell them a lie, something that you didn't want them to know the truth about, do you think that lie would disappear into your head when you spoke to them and go away? Or do you think that lie would be right at the front of your mind? Well, of course, it would be right at the front of your mind because you lied to them and you have to continue to lie. What if they ask more questions about it? So you're always thinking about your lie. And when people are thinking about their lie and you let them talk, they will very often let something slip out. And that's why you don't keep interrupting them. You let them talk. So when this guy had said he set the house up and he got done and we kind of sat there quietly for a minute and I said, well, can you tell me, what does it mean you set the house up? Well, when I said that, he had one of them looks like out of a cartoon. His eyes, he kind of, his head rattled, his eyes opened wide and he looked at me and he goes, well, what I just told you, I told you, I checked the lights, I checked the heat, I said, I know. You checked the heat, you checked the lights, you told the neighbors, you did all those things, but you also said you set the house up. What does that mean you set the house up? Well, at this point, he was flabbergasted. He didn't know what to say. Then he started accusing, are you accusing me of burning my house down? I said, Frank, we never said you burned your house down. Did you burn your house down? And after another 10 or 15 minutes, he broke down, started crying, and admitted that, yes, indeed, he did burn his house down. Long and short story, he had an affair several years earlier. His wife caught him. She said, if you ever do this again, I'm leaving you. I'm going to take the house. I'll take everything you have. He went back with the girlfriend, and he figured if I burn the house, we split the money, and I get off on my life. So that's why he did what he did. But the whole process here of conducting an interview and looking at this is what happens in law enforcement, and it's dramatic and it was very interesting, and that's why people are interested. So if you're interested in it, you want to get my book called The Investigation. That's the next book I wrote, and that's about a real criminal case that I use as a backdrop for conducting a criminal investigation. And you know what? It's about a double homicide, so it's really crazy cop stuff. So maybe we'll talk about that the next time we get together. So remember, The Interview and The Investigation from Blue 360 Media, and they're on here on the America Out Loud platform as well. You can go find them there. All right, this is Lieutenant Joe saying, hey, remember, be a part of the solution, not a part of the problem. If you love cop stuff, let me know.